This is Ray Haberski for New Books in Intellectual History. My interview today is with Ajay Marotta. He is a professor of law at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. And his book, Making the Modern American Fiscal State, Law, Politics, and the Rise of Progressive Taxation, 1877 to 1929, is an excellent book, and it is the recipient of the 2013 Society of U.S. Intellectual History Book Award. Ajay is a very good thinker. He has written a very rich book. It is full of fascinating personalities, but what perhaps distinguishes it the most is that it is at the cutting edge, the leading edge of new intellectual history, because it combines political history, economic history, really well done, well read profiles of particular people and institutions, and he writes beautifully. So it's a fascinating book that I think will have a quite a wide audience, and as we talked about in the interview, should have a lot of influence on graduate students and future studies of American fiscal politics.
Hi, Ray.
Hi, Ajay. Welcome to New Books in Intellectual History. Today we'll be talking about your latest book, Making the Modern American Fiscal State, Law, Politics, and the Rise of Progressive Taxation, 1877 to 1929. Welcome, Ajay Marotta. I am thrilled to have you sit down for this interview. I wanted to also mention that, as we just talked about, that your book won the prize this year for Society of U.S. Intellectual History, and which is somewhat curious since, as you said, you had actually put in papers in past conferences and had not been accepted. And yet here you are winning the book prize for the Society this year. How do you explain that? What do you think that means?
Well, that's an interesting question. I wasn't sure that you were going to mention that. Well, first, let me say I'm grateful and honored to have won the prize. Really, this I have been following the Society's development since its beginnings, and I was not able to actually attend the first couple of conferences, I remember, because of locations. But then I had a I had the opportunity to submit an orphan paper. I think at least once. I think twice, actually, and it was not selected. But it was. I'm not sure exactly why, but I know, having been on program committees, that orphan papers are hard to integrate into panels, and that's much easier if someone submits an entire coherent panel. So I completely understand that. And I also think that I do think of my work as intellectual history, the history of economic and legal and political ideas, first and foremost. So in that sense, and I know that the discipline or the subfield of American intellectual history has been evolving over the years. I know certainly when I was in graduate school, and I think in the recent past, people didn't really talk about American intellectual history as a subfield. No, this was the sort of dead field of high-minded philosophers. And so it was the field, as I understood it, was moving more towards the cultural circulation of ideas, rather than sort of this kind of understanding about the internal coherency or inconsistency of ideas. You know, we'd moved beyond that. We were now more interested in ideas as a cultural artifact. And so that was really, which I think is a terrific move that the subfield has made over the years. And so I do some of that in my work was in some ways more like the political and economic history of ideas that I don't think is old-fashioned. That's probably not the right word. Right. I don't want to say it's outdated. Right. But certainly it wasn't where the field was going, I think, is a fair way to put it. Although I do think the field has been going in a direction that I think, I mean, certainly I'm a part of this. I see myself as contributing to this and being a product of how intellectual and political history have been combining in the last few years. So
absolutely.
Lots of people, I think lots of them, not just Americanists, but lots of historians who have been interested in state building, for example, and empire. Empire is a very important concept in the historical profession right now, have been interested in the ideas that underpin the development of empires and state building. And so I'm a product of, and hopefully a contributor to, this synthesis between sort of a new political history and a new American intellectual history. At least that's how I like to think of my work.
I completely agree. I mean, Ajay, the reason that we're going to profile you and your book at the conference is coming up in a couple of weeks, and it will draw a big crowd, is because there's no doubt that you are one of the leading exponents of this sort of new intellectual history, you know, which is always when we put a moniker on a term like that, it's because it combines multiple fields. And we're happy that we can claim you, at least for now, as an intellectual historian.
Absolutely. No, yeah. For now and forever, I think. I've always, this is what attracted me to graduate school and my dissertation topic. And what I wanted to study was really this combination of ideas and the law. So I come from
absolutely
some background in the law. And so in American legal thought for many years, the literature has been pretty high-minded about the great ideas of the great jurists and how they have evolved over time. And at the same time, of course, the American, at least the American historical profession, has been taking a much more bottoms-up kind of social history approach. And so I like to think I'm sort of operating at that meso level between the two. That
you
it's
are.
Not just
no doubt
about the ideas, but how the ideas actually, first, how they're put into policy. That's, I think, one of my contributions I'm really trying to make is to show how these ideas, mostly of political economists and jurists, but not just them, but also populist farmers.
I talk
about populist farmers and labor organizers and how their visions of a fair and just fiscal order influenced law and public policy.
Yeah.
And then in turn, how that law and public policy got operationalized through the administrative state. So I very much claim myself as part of this movement of new American intellectual history.
Well, let me to sort of go bottom up with your own story. Can you tell us, you know, how you got to this point? You know, what was your training? What got you interested in the kind of topic that you include in this book?
That's a great question as well. So I actually was an economics concentrator in college, but I was one of these liberal arts lemmings, sort of not knowing what to do, just following the – I was changing my major constantly, I think. I just turned out that I graduated with a concentration in economics.
Okay.
But I did take a lot of history courses, and including with David Hollinger when he was at Michigan, and Stephen Tonser, a name that most people probably don't know, who's a European intellectual historian who I had very early in my undergraduate education as a professor. Who was just a real mensch. Hasn't published a lot, but was a dedicated teacher who took a sort of scared and shy sophomore into a European intellectual history course and just threw books at me. Literally, I would come to his office hours. Oh, you've got to read this. You've got to read that. And that was terrific. And
I
was very much interested in the history of ideas from a very early stage. And then I did go to law school immediately after. After undergraduate, but I was still very much interested in the history of ideas and legal ideas. And so even in law school, classes on jurisprudence are the ones that excited me. And I was lucky enough to have sort of interdisciplinary mentors even in law school.
That's
sociologists.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. The legal historian Dan Ernst, who I have to mention, was a real role model for me. Dan is trained both in law and history, a labor historian.
Yeah.
And so doing independent study with Dan was really influential. Mark Tushnet, the constitutional historian, was another important inspiration for me. And so these folks gave me a model of how you could be interested in ideas and see how the ideas, again, in action, the application of these ideas was really important. And so after law school, I actually thought about going to graduate school in history, but I had some large law school loans to pay off and things of that sort. And so and I developed some interest in tax. So there was another faculty member when I was at law school at Georgetown who taught me a lot about the importance of tax law. So I actually worked for a couple of years in that field doing some very interesting things. There was a lot of smart people in the corporate world, but essentially helping corporate America build the U.S. Treasury is not what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And so, but I learned a lot about taxation. So when I went to graduate school, at a time when there were still the ripple effects of some of the historical institutionalism that social scientists were working on. And so there was still a lot of, and this was still probably a good decade after Bringing the State Back In had been published, the famous volume of essays. But it was having, I think, a resounding effect in the world of history. And so I became interested in some of the state-building literature. I worked with Bill Novak at the University of Chicago, and Bill was one of the Bill and Amy Stanley were one of the reasons why I went to graduate school at Chicago. And I was reading all this literature on state-building. I noticed that it was almost always focused on the spending side. So it's all about social welfare policy, really.
Right.
If you go back to that volume and even a lot of the studies that came out of historical institutionalism. And I was very curious about the other end of the spectrum. How do you actually raise the money to actually do this kind of spending on military and social welfare spending? And I realized there wasn't enough literature on that. There was, of course, Sven Steinmo's work in political science and some other earlier work in history. Of course, Elliot Brownlee's work, who I've gotten to know and his work quite well over the years. But there was, I thought, a real need to kind of talk about and understand how the financing of our modern administrative, regulatory, social welfare state came to be. And for me, while a lot of it was about the material, the law and administration, I was really interested in the ideas that got us there. You know, what is it, this notion that we should have a progressive income tax based on the idea of ability to pay? And that little phrase plays an important role in my book project. And because it really comes, I mean, if you take a tax law class in a law school, for example, it's sort of assumed that, we have a system based on ability to pay. And I wanted to investigate, where did that come from? Mm-hmm. Where did that become the phrase?
That's a wonderful question.
Impact.
It's a wonderful question. Simple, but incredibly profound.
It really was a very simple question in that sense. And I didn't really know, there was some literature on this, but not much. And some of it was rather polemical and written in some cases by lawyers or policymakers who were making a very normative position on the stance. And my goal was to apply historical analysis in a more objective way to figure out, well, who were the key figures and how did they come up with the ideas, not only the origins. Again, this is where I think this is part of the new intellectual history, not just ideas, but ideas in action.
Right.
Was to see how did they then get these ideas out of the academy and union halls and farmer associations, where, again, it wasn't just the high-minded political economists, although they were the harnessing force, I argue, in the book. But, you know, this was a sort of groundswell of view about changing the fiscal order. And then in the process, as I was doing the research, realized that these folks were really trying to do more than just change the tax system, and that's something else I try to argue in my book. It really was a new vision about a different kind of polity, and therefore a different kind of relationship between subject and sovereign, between individual and state. These notions of citizenship then started sprouting up in the primary sources as I was looking at them. I said, well, gee, you know, this is a book about taxation, but it's really not. I mean, taxation is just the lens. It's just the window into this really critical and pivotal period of state formation in which notions of civic identity and administrative power are all kind of wrapped up together. And so that's what I wanted to explore. Yeah. So in some ways, the book really is a nice confluence of a lot of my earlier interests in training and education.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things after reading the book that I felt that I could go into a classroom and teaching a second half of the U.S. survey right now and talk to the students in a much more sort of clear way about the relationship between ideas and institutions, the way that people, individuals carry ideas with them into the institutions and change institutions, the way that you have these sort of punctuated moments, sort of like the complexity theory punctuating equilibriums.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, this and all through the debate over tax, over how the state commands people to do different things. This is one of the things that it does. And some people, I mean, it's very easy in some ways to talk about the military, but I think you've actually discovered the cognate to that, you know, to create community, to create citizenry, you need to tax. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about this, the dividing line between what came before ability to pay and why the idea of ability to pay changed the way we thought about each other in many ways through our tax system.
Yeah. So the way I chronicle this transformation in the book is that to be honest, I don't think it's fair, and I try to have this nuance in the book. But now, having read the book and talked about it to lots of people, let me underscore the point about trying to be more nuanced. In the late 19th, or at least in the 19th, late 19th century, I don't think there is one coherent ideology to contrast with ability to pay. So I don't want to create a kind of binary that it was one thing and then shifted to another.
Okay.
There was an amalgamation of justifications and ideology for why we should have a protective tariff, for example, or why at the subnational level we ought to have a property tax.
Right.
The thread that I try to pull out of that out of that amalgamation, especially certainly at the subnational level, I think also at the national level, is this notion of benefits.
Okay.
So there really is in this in the earlier period, in the Ancien regime, as I try to describe it, this notion that the state has this sort of reciprocal responsibility with individuals. So individuals make a payment through tax, and they get public goods, right? This very kind of what I call a commodified view of state-society relations, right? And I think in the book I use Justice Cooley as one of the exemplars of this. And I think if you go back to his treatise, as I try to show, he's reflective. He's not the only one, but he's reflective of the mindset that taxation really is this kind of quid pro quo between the state and the individual citizens.
Yeah.
And that changes at the turn of the 20th century. And as we already know from all the fine work that other intellectual historians have already done, that the turn of the century is when we start thinking, because of the Industrial Revolution and all the dramatic changes that are occurring, a greater sense of interdependency.
Yeah.
Right? It's no longer about the independent self or individual. There is this greater concern about how individuals are embedded in a much broader social, political, and economic environment. And so I certainly play off of that and try to show how taxation, in a sense, is reflective of that. So as we make this dramatic shift to a greater interdependent world in which there's recognition of this, you start seeing people wondering, you start seeing political economists. So the political economists become my sort of harness or voice for this.
Right.
But they really are bridging a gap between the masses and the educated sort of policymakers. I try to treat him in the kind of Leon Fink sense of these progressive era intellectuals playing this critical bridge building role. And what they come up with is, well, wait a minute, maybe if we live in a more interdependent world, then maybe it is not simply about a quid pro quo. Maybe citizenship entails these kinds of ethical duties and obligations that we then ought to see reflected in policy.
Yeah, fascinating.
And the policy I really focus on is tax policy.
Right.
So the political economists Seligman and Richard Ely and the two Adams, Henry Carter as well as Thomas S. Adams in the project, really push for this notion that the benefits theory of taxation is sort of obsolete in a world in which the state is everywhere. Right. So there's also this recognition that because of interdependency, that it's not just the state providing pure public goods, as we would say today. It's not just about defense, which was the dominant rationale
Absolutely.
For taxation. Right.
Yeah.
You pay taxes because the state protected you. Right.
Right.
Protected
you. Yeah.
Yeah,
as an industry, yeah, right.
Exactly. And so that and what the progressives are arguing is that in a liberal democracy, there's much more that a state ought to do, care for the general welfare of the Commonwealth.
Yeah.
And so if that's the case, well, then maybe there's a greater obligation on the wealthy, for example, right? So there's a material aspect to my story in the sense that this is a story about redistribution, but not a redistribution, a radical redistribution of wealth, but at least a redistribution of responsibility in the sense of who's going to underwrite the modern state.
I mean, it seemed to me reading that this was also a book about modernity and coming to sort of terms with the idea of the modern world.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's what I mean by the greater awareness of an interdependency.
Yeah.
That it was no longer this sort of pre-modern view of the individual and the self doing everything and therefore only having to provide taxes for the direct benefits they receive from the state.
Where did this come from? Where did these ideas, what are the leading proponents of your argument for how these guys are carrying these ideas forward? Where did they get these ideas? How did they come to terms with them?
So I think it's a combination of influence. And then in the book, I mean, these political economists, and this is the Dan Rogers story about Atlantic crossings in many ways.
Right.
They're all German trained, just about all German trained. At least the ones I focus on, the pivotal ones in tax policy, are spending a significant amount of their early formative education in Germany, learning at the foot of the German historical school of political economists and looking at Bismarck's social welfare state and seeing, oh my goodness, you know, that there are all these positive things that the state can do. And of course, they bring that back. And, you know, there's this famous scene in The Creation of the American Economic Association where Richard Ely, this is well documented in Dorothy Ross's work and Mary Ferner's work, as well as Jim Kloppenberg's, that Ely in particular really pushes the notion that economics ought to be about the study of state power, because the state is an ethical agency. That's the phrase he uses.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Right. And it gets struck in out of the charter. But there is this debate about state power at this time. And again, part of it is this influence of European ideas. But as I try to point out in the book, the political economists are true historicists. They know that the context matters, and they know that they're not going to transplant wholesale Bismarckian social welfare state to the United States, you know, late 19th, early 20th century liberal America.
Right.
And so they have to mold their acceptance of these ideas. They have to frame them in a particular American idiom, which then I try to trace, you know, says that, wait a minute, the notion of ability to pay and progressive taxation, that's not a German idea.
Yeah.
Look, you can go back to Adam Smith. So there's this Anglo-American tradition that they appeal to. You can go back to some of the key American economists who preceded them to talk about how there is this, as society changes, that the forces of modernity impinge upon thinking, upon policy, the tax policy ought to change as well.
I mean, it's so interesting. The terms that I didn't expect to discover in a book on basically fiscal history.
Yeah.
I mean, progressivism, I sort of understood that this would be a theme because of the period, but the idea of charity changes. The idea of community evolves. I know that you've been working in this area for a bit. Were you surprised in some ways that those were terms or themes that started to emerge out of your work?
Yeah, no, I was too. As I was saying earlier, I began thinking about this was going to be a story about ideas, and then ideas about material issues, funding the state.
Yeah.
And then how those ideas then get picked up by key lawmakers and policymakers. But this is where the notion of fiscal citizenship was very helpful to
me.
Because I was looking more at these political economists and public intellectuals who are pushing for a progressive income tax, they are doing it with these words about community and how community entails greater ethical duties and obligations, particularly on the well-to-do. I mean, that was the really interesting part about all this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially the way these ideas then get translated into law and policy, the early income tax is a rich man's tax. It's really just the super wealthy are going to pay it. But it's part of this notion of a, as you suggest, a greater sense of community and looking out for the commonwealth, that they have done better and that as a result, a greater obligation to give back. And then it does sort out. So I'm not sure. You actually mentioned something very, very interesting about so notions of charity. I don't see that right now. So I'd be helpful for my future work. If you can tell me a little bit more about where you think you see charity in this book, if you don't mind me asking, can I turn the tables?
Yeah, sure, sure.
You know, professors do this all the time.
Yeah, of course.
But I'm curious because I'm doing some new work on nonprofit stuff.
Okay.
Kind of dividing line between profit and nonprofit corporations. Yeah. So I'd be very curious to see where you saw the charity element in my story.
I'm thinking about it in terms of one of the areas I didn't see you do a whole lot with was religion, and it seems to me, but at the same time I. What I liked about this was that is an area religion doesn't have to be sort of pigeonholed into a particular box, right? And the idea of charity, I think, in the late 19th, early 20th century was a very important one in many churches, especially the Catholic Church. But point of having that sort of idea in those churches was not so that it would stay within the pews, but that it would seep into a larger community. If the Catholic Church was going to actually provide any sort of contribution to American thought, it was going to be through this idea of charity, primarily because they had so many low income, sort of relatively new immigrants, and they were trying to figure out what community would look like. I mean, they could not stay in the ghetto forever, right? They could not remain sort of the Poles and the Italians and the Irish set apart from everybody else. So I think the idea of charity was both quite internal to them, but is also something that I think many Catholic writers at the time try to suggest was part of this larger progressive era movement to redefine community. And charity was not simply sort of giving money to those who are in need, but being charitable in a much larger, almost idealistic sense.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's very interesting observation. Yeah, I know you're absolutely right. I mean, I do talk a little bit about the social gospel movement.
Yes, absolutely.
Its right. protagonist and the important role, because they are advocates of progressive taxation.
Right.
But you raise a really interesting point about how this notion of duty and obligation, again, something that historians of the progressive era have written about for a very long time, but how it crosses over beyond just the public realm,
right.
beyond just state building, but building community within churches. That's a really big. I'm going to have to think more about that and how I can integrate that more into my new work. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, but I guess my question would then be: so, what is this new work, and how is it how is it connected to the stuff that this has just come out?
Yeah, good question. So I'm kind of toying with the next major book project, because as everyone knows, when historians write books, it takes a lot longer than it does in other fields. And so committing that time,
right.
especially given the time it took to finish this last book, took me a lot longer than I thought it would. So I'm not quite sure what exactly the big project is, but I have been writing more recently about, and these are outgrowths of the book project. For example, I'm working on something now on corporate taxation. And so this is why your comment
right.
about charity was very interesting to me, because in the first half of the 20th century, at least, the taxation of business corporations is a very interesting story, and one that's not often told, because it's not just about raising revenue to fund a modern state and fund military, because obviously World War I and World War II are important. But as I try to talk about in the book project, corporations are seen as legal persons in certain areas. And so these notions of sort of our modern notion, or our contemporary notion today of corporate social responsibility, I think in some ways can be traced back to some of these earlier periods in which taxation plays a role in suggesting that that corporations, qua corporations, are citizens in some ways in
right.
our community,
right.
and therefore they have an obligation and a duty as well to at least one give back in the form of taxation. But then this notion of this broader notion of charity and community, I think, is also important. So I haven't developed that latter part, but I am working on a co-authored paper with a colleague of mine, looking at corporate taxation and the regulation of modern business in the early 20th century. So again, kind of combining again my interest in intellectual and legal history with
that's
a little
excellent.
Bit of business history now. Yeah,
it's excellent. So how has the response been to the book?
Pretty good so far. I mean, as you know, it takes a while for the academic journals to get
right.
The reviews out, but there have been a couple of reviews online, and surprisingly to me, in a tax trade journal.
I'm not surprised.
I didn't think this would exactly appeal. Well, I do teach in a law school, so I like to think that tax lawyers and tax professionals ought to be aware of their history.
Oh, I think they're going to love the book, honestly. I mean, you make sort of heroes out of some of their, I don't know, forebearers in a sense,
right? Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, especially the lawyers section.
Yeah,
I think the tax bar would like to know about what Arthur Ballantyne and others did to help build this modern fiscal polity.
Yeah.
And good point.
I mean, financial journals, have you had some responses in the business
not
world?
Not yet. Not that I have. I mean, you tell the press who you think is going to be interested, and so the book gets sent out.
Yeah.
So I don't know of any, at least. I mean, I would think at this point I would have heard about it. But yeah, so I think it's been about a year now. It's out in paperback now. So
yeah.
I'm hoping a more affordable paperback might get it into more people's hands and maybe get some more responses. But I've done a couple of author meets readers panels at conferences, and I'm going to do one at the Society for Intellectual History in a couple of weeks. So I'm looking forward to that. But so far, the reception's been pretty good. I'm very pleased and surprised in some ways. It has been so positive, but I'm elated.
I mean, one of the things that I think would lend itself to discussion among folks in the business community is that, I mean, you have not prescriptive, but I think you do have contextual ideas that they might consider in some of the debates today, right? I mean, how we fund things and why we fund things today. So I'm curious, have you had any interactions like that where people say, well, the income tax was a bad idea to begin with, or there should be a flat tax, or, you know, the rates are either too low or too high? I mean, have you entered into any of those discussions with?
Yeah, a little bit. So I've tried to do my hand in a little bit of op-ed writing. So I've tried to do it in that way and just get out the ideas to a broader public
yeah.
that there was this moment in American history when we actually believed in progressive taxation. I mean, people supported it. Well, that, and that's the thing, right? Is that
yeah.
in some ways it falls on deaf ears today because obviously things have changed dramatically since the 1970s. We are in a very, and I try to, in the conclusion of the book,
I try to
point out of how, in many ways, I am writing about this sort of lost moment in American history when we really did believe in public power, had faith and confidence in the state, and wanted to contribute to it because we thought it was actually maybe not an ethical agency, but certainly a positive agency in human welfare. And that doesn't ring true today. And so when I do get into these, when I do write these op-eds, usually I get a lot of angry letters,
that
I'm a socialist, that all progressive taxation is wrong, mm-hmm. and, we ought to abolish the IRS.
And what is their basic argument for that? Is that the state doesn't know what is best for the individual, or that people are going to exploit it, and therefore my money will be lost in a way that it shouldn't be otherwise? I mean, what is it?
It's a lot of those things. And if we bracket sort of the lunatic fringe, which ipso facto
the state is evil.
Let's just bracket those folks.
Right.
That's obviously not going to. I think the more thoughtful conservative response has been, and not just to me, but to everyone who still writes, believes that we ought to have a robust public sector.
I think the
usual kind of Tea Party and conservative mm-hmm. rallying cries that it's all fraud, waste, and abuse. Right? Yeah. That the growth of the Leviathan is out of control. It actually does not. It does more work. Get government off our back, right? The Reagan refrain is, I think, still very much with
us. Very important. Absolutely.
Yeah. Although there's a counter narrative, right? And that's what I think I'm trying to do. And I think a lot of other folks who are writing about the state, and not just in the Progressive at other times, to suggest that, wait a minute, one, we didn't always all think this way.
That's right.
So maybe I don't do it enough in the conclusion, but I really, and I've been thinking about this since the beginning of this book project, is we ought too often draw a direct and straight line from the revolution and then the original Tea Party to Newt Gingrich, and all the other conservatives all the way through to the Tea Party today, as if American history has always and everywhere been anti-statist and anti-tax.
Yeah.
And that's just wrong.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, and that's what I think us historians are good at, is reminding folks that there's a much more complicated historical narrative that you have to grapple with. There were moments in time when people believed in shared sacrifice, another phrase that comes up a lot in the book project.
I would say for a much longer time, for many, many more people.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And so, I'm not trying to be clairvoyant or a prophet about whether we're ever going to go back to that kind of thinking, but at least one of the prescriptive or the kind of quasi-normative parts of my book is at least to remind readers that we haven't always
absolutely.
And everywhere been anti-statist and anti-tax.
Right. That's a great benefit of the book.
That's one of my, I hope, one of my big upshots or my big takeaways.
So I want to ask you one more question, and it has something to do with my own experience traveling abroad. I lived in Denmark for a year as a Fulbrighter. And of course, they have a very different type of tax system, right? And when I talk about it, people are sort of dumbfounded that 60% of the top salaries are taken away in some sort of tax. But yet what I saw there, it seemed to me, was that the tax system functioned sort of like a civil religion to people. They believed in it in a way that I don't think I've ever heard, at least in my lifetime, I've heard Americans the way they speak about the tax system. And of course, the social welfare system is pretty deep there, but it doesn't have that long of a history. And I'm just mm-hmm. curious, do you have any sense of a comparative point of view on this?
Absolutely. This is really important. And as you know, I do mention this in the bookends, the intro and the conclusion of the book. I do try to take a comparative perspective because I think there is a telling irony or paradox about the triumph of the ability to pay logic in the early 20th century.
Yeah.
And that is that we become then fixated on the income tax and a progressive income tax. Because if you look at, you look at the comparative political economy literature, the U.S. actually has a very progressive tax system, at least pre-1980, compared to other Western industrialized nations. OECD data shows we actually have a rather robust progressive tax system up until the 80s. Yet, we don't do as much for poverty, right? And
right.
So there's this kind of paradox or question about why. And so I try to make the argument, again, this is somewhat speculative in the book. I don't demonstrate this, but that there's this path-dependent moment. So in the early 20th century, when the ability to pay logic is gaining steam and when it's being translated into policy, it kind of leads to this fiscal myopia that I refer to in the book, that we think of income taxes and progressive taxation as the way, as the only way in which we can address some of these larger social dislocations that come with modern capitalism.
Yeah.
But then if you look comparatively, though, especially the Scandinavian countries are always held up as the as a model,
right.
Incredibly regressive tax system, right? So there's a VAT. There's a
right.
value-added tax
right.
in Sweden that's as high as 50% on just about everything.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
amazing, right?
Yeah.
And if you were to just look at the tax side, you'd say, oh my gosh, you know, it's the Americans who are much more progressive and forward-thinking.
Yeah.
But you've got to tie the tax with the spending side.
Yep.
And so, of course, if you look at the Scandinavian countries, they have an enormous amount of social welfare spending, right? And we do not. And I don't want to suggest that it all goes back to ability to pay, but I think the ability to pay does kind of lock in American thinking in this, as I say in the book, in this kind of myopic way that it's really just about the tax side. And we don't think as holistically, I think, about tax and spending together as some of our comparative neighbors in Scandinavia, for example.
So let me ask you, why? I mean, why did the disconnect develop as almost as hard and fast as it is?
Yeah, so I mean, I don't want to over-determine
the importance
of ideas. It's not just about ideas.
Right.
Certainly,
institutions are important. Yeah.
Institutions are absolutely critical.
Yeah.
Junko Kato's another historical institutionalist has written about this.
Yeah.
And so there's a whole bunch of reasons. It's not just about ideas. It's certainly about our constitutional design.
Right.
The many veto points that we have. We have a parliamentary system.
Right. The winner takes all. Yeah. Right.
Exactly. So there's a whole bunch of other reasons why we've, I think, become locked into this. And again, though, as a historian, I'd like to think that because these things are contingent,
that's right.
None of this is inevitable or
right.
natural, neutral, and necessary.
And it can
right?
change.
We could change this.
Yes.
Exactly right.
Yes.
And I guess the other upshot of my book is to demonstrate to people that, wait a minute, you know, we happen to go down this paradoxical or ironic path, but that doesn't mean we have to stick with it.
Yeah.
Right? We could, given changing historical conditions and today's dire need for revenues and increased healthcare spending down the road, we might think about something like the value-added tax.
Yeah. Ajay, it's been great to talk to you. This is an incredibly rich book that has a lot of dimensions to it that I think that people will be reading for quite a few years to come. And I'm sure there are a bunch of dissertations waiting to come out of it, you know, for students.
That's the truest honor. You just
it really,
write this,
yeah.
you know, it gets on some reading lists and maybe some dissertations. But this has been a terrific interview. Thank you very much, Ray, for the time. I really enjoyed this discussion.
My name is Ray Hibersky, and you've been listening to New Books in Intellectual History. I interviewed with Ajay Marotta and his new book, Making the Modern American Fiscal State, Law, Politics, and the Rise of Progressive Taxation, 1877 to 1929.